close-shaven, properly combed, suit-and-tie kind of guy. And he didn't smell dusty. He smelled like the metal and oil of a machine shop. Red Sea or otherwise, she says, he gets very excited about his next big business idea. Mom isn't as into taking risks. That's one of the things they talk about in their chairs. They pretend like they aren't trying to change each other. But I know what it sounds like when Mom or Dad is upset with me, and they often sound just like that. In a different past life, I expect a few centuries later, Nancy wasn't big on the timeline. Mom and Renee were fellow Buddhist, Taoist, Shinto nuns together in Asia. I'm not certain of their exact denomination, but they were nuns and friends and somewhere on the Asian continent and shared a nun lifestyle. I bet they were good nun buddies. Mom would love the nun homework, and my sister would have excelled in the prayer position. And they both adore ponchos. Deanie had one life with my mother as well. I'm jealous. As it turns out, a few lives back, my father had killed my Aunt Gladdy, which to Gladdy, never a huge fan of my father, this explained a lot. They'd been fighting silently for years, my father the black sheep, leaving the family valve business and church. I got a different sort of past life update. I settle into our giant leopard bean bag. Nervous to hear, I tuck my arms under my knees, not all splayed out like normal. Nancy's in a chair. As I think if she got down in the bag with me, she'd never get out. I imagine she knows this. This beanbag is still the heart of our house, where Mom read us Winnie the Pooh and The Wind in the Willows and every other great book she brings home from the children's bookshop, where she's worked for years. We're getting into older books like Bridge to Terabithia. It's so cozy that Dad sometimes falls asleep when we're doing it. You were a fairy, Nancy says. A blue fairy. Fairies often live on or near mushrooms. Do you like mushrooms? What? That means this is your first time on planet Earth.
My first what?
I look up at her quizzically. If I were bolder, I would ask to start over. Megan, I'm getting... This is your first time on the planet, what we call Earth. There are other names, but... What? Did you ask if I like mushrooms? I don't like eating them particularly, but I... Yes. Do you like mushrooms? I've dreamed about them, about being upset when people kick dirt on them, like ones on edges of trails with spotted tops. Ah, yes, I see. Nancy was closing and fluttering her eyes strangely. Did you say this is my first time here? Are you sure this isn't Renee's first, or my mom's, maybe Deanie's? Maybe my Aunt Donnie. Dad's older sister was downstairs. She always seemed a little arty and out there, with lots of floral, laughter, and oil painting. I loved how she laughed. I liked her. I didn't know if I felt like her, but I liked her. I didn't like this alone business. I won't talk about others, but I can tell you I'm getting this strongly. Why is it I have to be the only one new to the planet? It matched how I felt, but I didn't like hearing it. I don't want to sound like I think I'm special because I know everybody is, so I don't like this topic, feeling different. But when I feel sad, my crying feels big and comes out with a roar. When I laugh, it comes louder and faster than the rest and seems harder to stop. When I don't understand something, I really don't understand, and my questions are always longer and more complicated. It's embarrassing. I don't particularly like this about myself. I mean, sure, it feels good to laugh, but I often seem to feel things are funnier when funny, sadder when they're sad, and more confusing when confused. I worry I tire my parents out. But I can't seem not to ask. When I try to be quiet, I seem to not do that as unnoticeably as the quiet people. Suddenly, somebody wants to know why I'm so quiet. When I told Mom, Dad, and Renee at dinner this new-to-the-planet stuff, they slowly nodded. Mom said, "Of course. That absolutely makes sense." They laughed and looked at each other like they'd heard something that made them feel really smart. I didn't like thinking it was all that funny. Feeling exposed, I studied Renee. More than laughy, she looked downtrodden, as if her sandy blonde waves would droop from the discussion. Looking back, what I guess Renee heard was, "Megan is different. Megan is special." All I heard was, "Megan's on the outside, trying very hard to get in, wherever in is." What do they mean that it absolutely made sense? And what about this other aura stuff? Nancy says I'm a yellow, but everybody else was far cooler colors, blues and violets. Nancy says yellows want to bring joy to others and have tremendous energy. Drawn to creative endeavors, supposedly yellows pick fields like writing, comedy, healing arts, outdoorsy stuff like park rangers. Honestly, specifically park rangers and athletic pursuits. They often have more than one profession in their lives, and they like variety and are health nuts. And their biggest fear? Abandonment. Also, Nancy explains, yellows are natural healers. Something about that unusual volume of energy. Apparently, I can put it to good use. She instructs me rather ominously. One last thing, she says as she leans down into the beanbag and into my eyes. Should you ever find yourself near a car accident, put your hands gently on the injured party ever so subtly. What am I supposed to say? Stand back? I'm a yellow? I should be writing this stuff down. Energy, new to planet, hands. I'm not totally alone on the fairy front, though. Dini says she has a guardian angel named Kesla who has saved her from numerous mishaps. I'm not sure I believe her, but I kind of do. She mentions Kesla often, like it's the most normal thing in the world. If Dini wasn't an actual fairy, at least she knew one. Angel, fairy, what's the difference? And like me, Dini's loud, and her laughs are big and slobbery, and she tells the best stories. Among them, a near fall off a cliff before Kesla yanked her to safety. Maybe being a blue fairy is something like that. And I did have that dream about mushrooms. But if I was a blue fairy, I didn't understand why I was a yellow or a human now. To get the most out of the deal, I brought Nancy a big baseball card stack of my friend's school photos. Mom said if there was time, Nancy could run through the photos to identify my friend's auras. I wasn't sure I believed this color business, but how did you prove there weren't auras? My scientific method? To see if the description of the colors matched my friend's. Most of my friends were blues, which is supposedly somehow opposite of a yellow. My entire family is blue, except Dad, who's violet. Blues are super spiritual, but have a hard time taking love in or something. They say blue parents unconsciously try to get their kids to be dependent on them. Violets are visionary and powerful and kind of out there. Yep, that fits. I try to remember the formulas of the color wheel. Nancy says it means my insides are the same as what my friends and family show on the outside. Like blues are emotional and nurturing, whereas yellows hide that direct care and emotion and help by being entertaining or bringing energy to the group. Blue sounds better, more serious. I would rather be a nurturing blue than feel like I'm loud or from another planet or too bright and yellow like the sun and make people squint or turn away. I don't want to be forgotten, but I'd rather not stick out either. I fear I'm too much, like I came out of Mom raring to go, and I'm too loud, too sad, too happy, too. At least I'm not a crystal. Grandpa Don is crystal. Crystal is like no color, which is bad. Nancy told Dini that Grandpa Don is in denial of his color, which makes him crystal somehow. But apparently there's a cure for it. Dini makes him sleep in pink sheets to compensate. Chapter 6. Est Children's Training. Purpose. It's all a little hazy now. I'm supposed to come out of this different. Duration. 4 days. Equipment needed. Name tags, uncomfortable conference chairs, and a vivid imagination. Lucky me. Age. 12. The age range is 5 to 12. The bulk of the kids are on the young side. Relationship status. A guy named Peter asked me to go with him. I didn't answer right away. He got impatient. I told him if he didn't like me enough to wait for my answer, then the answer was no. Employment. Standard chores, room cleaning, dishwasher, homework, piano. Cost. Around $500. Humiliation factor. Has real potential. Location. Phoenix, Arizona. Some industrial park, classic conference room, arranged theater style, a stage, a sketch pad, an easel, and a director's chair for the trainer. Mom and Dad have finished their EST training in Newport Beach, California. The vibe of it? Honestly, a little culty minus the Kool-Aid. Werner Erhard is the founder, and our family will become friends with one of his brothers who is tall, likable, and not able to keep it in his pants. S stands for either Erhard Seminars Training or It Is in Latin. Their training takes place at the Orange County Fairgrounds. I go to their graduation. It's all very smiley. Apparently, the course entailed various confessions to secret abortions or somebody not feeling connected to their father, and this has produced a bond among the graduates that I don't fully understand. The stated goals: to be more effective in relationships, make better decisions, develop integrity and awareness. Done in a group of 75 to 200 people. By the time graduation rolls around, I feel the enthusiasm from the staff to enroll new people. High-pressure sales. Even at 12, I can feel it. So I'm all signed up to do it. Maybe I'm game because I've always loved the fairgrounds. I love how you can smell the horses. A few months later, I sit nowhere near the Orange County Fairgrounds, but in Phoenix with a room full of kids in my own training. My mother likes to say I choose to do these things for myself. Admires me for it. But really, does a cow in the herd choose to get branded? My mom believes in the unique cow, the Jonathan Livingston Seagull independent cow that chooses to fly or moo their own way. We have that seagull book all over the house. Days earlier, we, Mom, Dad, Renee, my friend Kimberly, and her far hipper and much younger parents, Gary and Marilyn, had driven our Bluebird motorhome to Arizona to do it, my family's idea of a vacation. Now settled into the children's training, Joanne, the trainer, introduces us to our next exercise, the danger process, to conjure what most scares us. I know that one easily, finding my parents dead in some freakishly twisted car accident. I've always worried about that, my parents dying before I'm grown. Kimberly's mother is about 20 years younger than mine. Maybe I worry because my mother has gray hair. Nobody's mother has gray hair. It makes her seem more fragile than other mothers. Joanne tells us to pick a spot on the ground, lie down, and get talked through the process. First, we need for you to create a safe space to go inside yourself should you become too frightened. I build a white room with beautiful textured walls with deep swirls. My version has four large windows, one on each wall, and somewhere, inside or outside the room, is a palette of rainbows. Please bring up the danger now. Bring up your issue. What does it feel like? What does it smell like? What does it sound like? On my back in the dark, the carpet feels itchy and smells like plastic. But in my mind, I conjure the crash, the call from the police, me slumped over my parents' corpses, trying to will them back to life, yet unable. The crash site, the smell of gasoline and burning flesh, the sound of the cop cars and ambulances, my parents trapped within the twisted metal of their sedan, firemen attempting to pull them out with matching jaws of life. What's the feeling? Express the feeling. Do you need to scream? Make that sound. What kids lack in emotional experience, they make up for in imagination and lack of inhibition. Within minutes, a room full of children cry and beg for help in the dark. The momentum builds, and soon, really, the most terrifying thing happening in the exercise is the blood-curdling screams and sobs coming from 75 5 to 12-year-olds. Chaos of the highest order. A chorus of, "Mommy, Mommy," weaving through, "Daddy, Daddy," with your standard, "Help!" as a refrain. The all-important, "No!" like a baseline anchoring us to the floor. Put it together and you've got a cacophony of, "Mommy, no, Daddy, help me, help!" Shooting up from the carpet, ricocheting across the room and crashing back into my chest. Pure bedlam. Somehow Joanne has to wind this fucker down before some 5-year-old has an aneurysm. It takes longer to calm everybody down than it did to ramp us up. Okay, now let's go back to our safe spaces. That's right, very good. Very good. Some kids keep crying. The room feels smaller than it did before. I have no idea how long it lasted. It could have been half an hour. It could have been two. The lights get turned back on as kids slowly get up. The little ones rub their eyes, wiped out. I'm exhausted. If I were a valve, somebody opened me all the way up and I feel bigger, wider. More water or emotion had pumped through me than I'd ever felt. Maybe it was okay to have all that emotion I spent so much time trying to keep organized. In the strangest way, I took up more space or could feel the edges of my body more clearly now, which I found oddly relaxing, especially for someone who feared feeling too much. But if the valve had opened, I couldn't tell if I'd closed it back upright. I thought I might still be leaking. Shouldn't they have shown me how to close it? I kept picturing those jaws of life, feeling so alone without my parents, wondering why I couldn't get to them. And then I remember. My parents weren't, in fact, dead, but would pick me up at the end of this session tonight. That's the weirdest bit. It's all so intense, and then it's dinner. I don't feel wrapped up. I feel raw, but not just raw. I'm hungry. I hope we go for Mexican. Maybe they'll take us back to that spot in Old Town where if you walk in wearing a tie, they cut it off and hang it from the ceiling. Chapter 7. Family Communication Exercise. Purpose. No bloody idea. We practice whatever technique Mom and Dad learned in this weekend's metaphysical and or self-improvement workshop. Duration. Varies. Typically, 1 to 2 hours. Equipment needed. Chairs, clock, timer, even better. Age, 13. Relationship status. We have a trampoline in our backyard, so a lot of the neighborhood hangs out here. I try to play with Renee, but she still keeps to herself mostly, so I hang out with my friends Brett and Nessa. Cost, free. But the original seminar probably cost around $300. Humiliation factor. Moderate. You can only be so embarrassed by your family. Location. Our living room. My mother has informed us that tonight we'll have a family seminar in the living room. Since your dad and I finished the communication workshop, we thought we'd work on our communication, what with our second pinch and all. The pinch. Our word, aka understatement, for a financial hardship in a failed business venture of Dad's when I was little. We're in our next one. Dad dreams of alternate fuel possibilities and cheese. He's leveraged it all, the house, his small business, our savings, to build a cheese whey factory to produce both ethanol and cheese. It requires Danish investors, Irish technology, and, for some reason, the purchase of Desi Arnaz's ranch in Corona, California. To say my father is risk-friendly and my mother risk-averse would be an understatement. It's weird between my parents. Each seems afraid that the other is in charge of their fate as a couple. It's like a confusing game of tennis where nobody can figure out whose turn it is to serve. Maybe if we actually did things together, you know, activities, instead of talk about communication ad nauseam, we, or maybe they, would actually feel closer. But nobody's asking me. Not yet, anyway. Maybe I'll bring it up at tonight's workshop. Mom gathers us in the living room, directing us like a hostess on a game show about to display the prizes behind curtain number one. The room is being remodeled, but slowly, so it's a bit of a construction zone. Out of money after phase one, it's now a project in two parts until we can afford phase two. My mom has chosen a thick Mexican tile, but was sick of the pea soup green carpet. I don't blame her, so she's ripped it up. So we sit in a cement-floored living room on a pea-soup green couch surrounded by velvety green wallpaper. Renee and I settle in because we know the drill. We know we are going to be here for an uncomfortably long time. I'm guessing an hour and a half, two tops. My Aunt Donnie says, as a family, we spend more time talking about where we'll eat dinner than they did about where or if my cousin Kenny would go to college. Despite the ribbing, I'm putting my hope in the workshop. Doesn't wanting to connect mean we are connected? I hope so. So now, Mom says, with a formality in her voice as if leading a room full of actual seminarians, we're going to do an exercise in simultaneous dialogue. One of us will call out colors and the other will match the calls. The goal? To pay so much attention to our partner that the exact same words will come out of both our mouths simultaneously. David, my mom asks, should we go first? Dad clears his throat. Is there anything about the exercise, she asks Dad, that you would like to add? He makes this sound a lot.
I believe that our judgments can really get in the way of truly listening and prevent us from understanding what's really going on.
Those may be his four favorite words. My parents like to talk in code. Now they're talking about each other. Exactly, my mom says, and people can feel highly unsupported when they aren't heard. Dad sits down on one of the dining room chairs he's dragged in across the cement. Mom follows. They face each other, the knees of their jeans almost touching. So your father will call out colors, and I will open myself to say the exact same words to really hear him. Dad, blue. Mom, blue. Dad, blue. Mom, blue. Dad, yellow. Mom, yellow. Dad, green. Mom, green. They're building speed. Blue, blue, orange, orange, green, blue. I mean green, green. And then it happens. They're speaking colors in unison. No longer two blues, but one. One yellow, one green, one orange. Set in stereo across Windsor chairs. They stop and look over at Renee and me. Why don't you two try it now? Mom asks, her hands presenting the chairs like Vanna White. Renee's eyes dart when nervous, as if surveying any scene for safety. She's darting. While speaking in unison is odd, I like the idea, like a trance. We take their seats. Dad sets his stopwatch. Ready, set, go. I focus on Renee's mouth. I feel like I'm at the starting blocks of a foot race, but with lip gloss. She begins the color shouts as we stare at each other. Red, red, green, green, blue, blue. I feel this anxiety, this heat, this adrenaline inside me as I stare only at her mouth as it forms these words. The staring tonight is less intense than some of the other exercises we've done. With this one, we don't have to stare in silence into each other's eyes. With eye-focused exercises, I've stared so hard at my sister's face, it would distort. Her perfectly straight, elegant nose would start to grow. Her dusting of freckles blurs. Her bee-stung lips inflate. On the upside, this is the most time we've spent together in a while. If we had to stare at each other shouting the color wheel for quality one-on-one, fine by me. But tonight, amid the red and the green and this blue, there is a nanosecond of a moment where my sister and I look at each other and smile underneath our serious faces, just to each other. While we live down the hall from one another, we're normally worlds apart. Yet now, without ever saying a word, and despite the miles of distance between us, there is an understanding that we are caught in something odd, earnest, but odd. And each of us knows the other will follow along as best she can. If we perform the exercise well enough, perhaps it will help bring these silently warring parties closer to a truce. This is part of our unspoken sisterly pact. One part of each of us hopes this workshop will somehow help our family, and the other is a silent bond like hostages with a shared fate. The job is not merely to endure the debrief, but to find ways to bring the exercise to a unified and pleasing end. Renee will do so with silence. I will scan the debrief for points where Mom and Dad might agree. If anything my father says sounds remotely similar to what my mother says, I echo like a Greek chorus. Tonight, the crevasse between them feels too wide. No point in even my best Greek chorus. It would only echo the distance. I look down at my Miss Piggy watch. The love boat is on. I'm missing it. I love the love boat. No conflict that enormous vessel can't cut through. 1 hour, 4 plot lines, and everything always works out in the end. And partway through, everybody gets time by the pool with a pretty umbrella drink. Joyce, my father says, what we need to come to some understanding about is that we each have our own highest sense of right. Oh, God. It's the highest sense of right talk. I look down at my watch again. I notice a small scratch on the face. I hadn't noticed that before. My perfect little watch is no longer pristine. How did this happen? When did it happen? I've been trying to be so careful. Can I please be excused? I ask. Dad looks startled, so focused on talking. I suspect he's forgotten anyone else is in the room. May you? Joyce, are we good with letting them go? Mom is caught up in something. The last 15 minutes have gotten thicker. The nights always get thicker. Yes, you may go, she says, not looking at us as she lifts her glasses to wipe her eyes. Why is there never Kleenex around when you need it? This room is definitely in need of a box. Joyce, what you don't understand. But David, not to be negative, I just... We will leave my parents as we do, to their words. Renee and I exit and head down the stairs to the family room. We both want to know what cruise director Julie McCoy is up to. She's so cute and bubbly. We don't yet know that in real life, she's addicted to cocaine. It's commercials, but we still have a half hour of Mazatlan to catch. Maybe I'll go bring a roll of toilet paper back into the living room. Maybe I can skulk in, make the toilet paper delivery to Mom, and skulk right back out unnoticed. It could go either way. All I know is neither Renee nor I utters a word about any of it. Chapter 8, Conscious Terminology. Purpose refers to a practice, like many in our house, to make our behavior more self-aware. Specifically, this describes the term communication withhold, an act of nonverbal antagonism wherein one party opts not to share some piece of vital information with a second party. Duration, a constant, a day in, day out, year out sort of thing. Equipment needed. A tolerance for terms and phrases you can't find in the dictionary. Age, 14. Relationship status. I like going to high school dances, but that's it. Dancing, no making out. My own rule. Cost, free. But the seminar where the phrase was taught cost a few hundred dollars. Humiliation factor, low. More fear than embarrassment. Location, anywhere where we talk to each other. House, car, grocery store, elevator, etc. The day my father fell off the roof, my mother was convinced it was because he had a communication withhold. This term was regularly thrown around our house as readily as other families called out that it was time for dinner. At any one time, one or all of us were in a seminar gathering new terms. The main goal was to make new life commitments. The most common, a circular commitment to enrolling new people. I'd signed up to do a weekly evening of cold calls to unregistered seminarians, like fundraising for the Red Cross, minus the charity bit. The whole thing conflicted me. On the one hand, I felt pride in working alongside full-fledged adults. On the other, I was bursting with shame for being extremely ineffective at my job. My 14-year-old voice didn't help. I was even more ineffective at hiding how badly I wanted to be good at something that simultaneously made me feel dirty. I was terrible pretending, the adults were far better, that we weren't pressuring people when we were. This was my withhold. The enrollment manager insisted it wasn't sales, rather we were helping others see the possibility of themselves. As fishy as it smelled in that sterile office, I kept repeating my manager's words, thinking that if I dug deep enough, the pressure vibe would drop away and both caller and callee would be transformed, like magic, like alchemy, water into wine. Another withhold? I wondered if all this business explained why I chose to memorize every lyric in the musical The Music Man, a story about a people-pleasing con artist and the sincere people who put hope in his tune. I wasn't sure if I was Connie or Connor, but all four of us found ourselves in a chorus of awkward proclamations in the name of self-betterment. We were manifesting possibilities and stepping into openings in lieu of more intimate talk. Getting close to difficult emotions was merely the awkward bit to make way for our new life-changing commitments. Perhaps it was perfect for us. We worshipped at the Church of Ideas. Not that I was sure what our ideas were, but ideas kept us from dealing directly with our tender underbellies. We didn't have to address why Renee was holed up in her room, or why Dad had to chase his next big idea, or what drove Mom to search, or how I nominated myself the clown who tried to joke and prod about our messy emotional stuff. Honestly, church sounded easier, with less recruitment. If my religion was to register strangers or develop wit to attempt connection, my mother's was more visceral. She had committed to not take pain pills or antibiotics in the middle of a urinary tract infection. Like me, I suspect she imagined if she slash we dropped deeper into whatever it was we were dropping into, then her slash our pain would vanish. Perhaps her motivation was an homage to her doctor-free Christian Science ideas, a trait Mom and Dad still shared. They could both have twinsies severed torsos in an auto accident and decide to just lie there in the road indefinitely, agreeing that the severing was just a mild misunderstanding. But I worried. Mom felt fragile in a way I didn't fully understand, so willing to wrestle alone, turning only to disciplines and classes. It didn't seem right for her to endure avoidable pain, like the UTI, for no reason. But you aren't supposed to counsel your parents. Everybody knows that. Yet I admired her earnest humility. We repeated with fondness a family war story about the time she withstood a multi-hour verbal firing squad of one when a seminar leader insisted she acknowledge she was a bitch for requesting a bathroom break for the entire group. She must have uttered the phrase, "I get that I'm a bitch," at the trainer's prompting dozens of times in dozens of tones, each announcement more sincere than the last. To me, a proper communication withhold might be Mom not saying, "I don't know how to get close to you, Dave, but I so love you." Or Dad not admitting, "I'm furious, Joyce, that you don't support my business risks." Or mine could be, "Could we make some family friends or just do fun stuff together, plant a garden, have a barbecue?" Instead, we withheld. But when it comes to communication withholds, sometimes falling off the roof maybe is just falling off the roof. My father went up there to put up Christmas lights. He was dressed in his rather tight blue sweatsuit stretched across his generous girth, upon which my sister had embroidered the words, "The Big Cheese," with a large piece of Swiss cheese appliqued across his chest. From inside the house, my mother and I heard this startling, "Rumble, rumble, smash! Rumble, rumble, smash!" He rolled off the first roof, landed on the second, then tumbled down through the clothesline, the trash cans, and then onto the 12-foot wooden ladder that somehow broke his fall. We ran out toward the ruckus and found him on his back, moaning, with the large piece of cheese heaving up and down as he struggled to regain his breath. And my mother, more frightened than angry, standing over him in her apple-a-day sweatshirt, yelling to my father's belly cheese, "David, I'm certain you have a communication withhold. I'm certain there is something you are not communicating with me, and because you didn't communicate with me, you checked out and fell off the roof." But my father, with the wind knocked out of him, his glasses catawampus, appeared hard-pressed to think of what that little tidbit of communication could possibly be. And my mother, because she was not a bitch, helped him limp to the bed anyway, because that's what you do when someone you love falls off the roof. But you do have a living room seminar the next day to get at the withhold. Chapter 9. Fantasize. Purpose. Something Mom and I do to entertain ourselves. Duration. We do this all the time. Takes anywhere from 20 minutes to 2 hours. Equipment needed. Car for cruising. Age, 14. Relationship status. It's mostly Mom and me. Dad travels constantly in pursuit of his cheese whey ethanol factory dream, and Renee's off to college. Employment. Still cold calling. Cost. Our hobby is free. It's why we especially like it. Humiliation factor. Quite its opposite. Location, Newport Beach, Babel Island, Laguna, and anywhere else we find ourselves. "Shall we take one more tour around the block?" Mom asks me. We have this conversation nearly every day. Might be the favorite time of day for both of us. Since I can't drive yet, she still has to drive me everywhere. School, ballet 5 days a week, volunteering for EST, visits with friends. I like being her co-pilot near her warm smell, like slightly overcooked English scones with hints of dried apricot. Every time we enter our neighborhood, this is what we both want to do. Look at houses, often the ones just in our small neighborhood, but we also branch out. And for any house that strikes our fancy, we can linger for some time. We imagine we live in every one, but we have our favorites. "How would you redo the door, Megan? Might that one have an airy kitchen? How would it be to have an English library? Wouldn't that be the perfect place for a hammock? If it were ours, shouldn't we do a Dutch glass door there? Do you remember if that one has a pool?" She's always done this, and I happen to like it, so we started to imagine together. She taught me things. About design. About her. When I was little, we moved all the time, you know, because Daddy kept running out of money. So back forth between California and Ohio. And since Daddy was still drinking and Mother was trying to get him sober, I spent a lot of time alone, wandering my neighborhood, imagining where I might live. Those big old screened-in porches, the dormered windows, old ice boxes at the front of the house where Daddy would deliver the ice. He stopped drinking at some point, right? Yes, such a kind man. But it never quite came together for him. Mother worked to keep us afloat, and soon we'd all work. You know, with Grandmother Kosher and her charity shop. It's where we got all our clothes. She's the one who taught me how to dress well with no money. I tried to make our houses look nice in that same way. Mother wasn't very tidy, so I got tidy for all of us. Did you like your childhood much? Good question. What with all the moving? I just had my two best friends in Ohio that I had to leave when we came back to California. I never had friends as fun as Margaret and Mary Ann again. I think that's when I tried to kill myself. She says this rather matter-of-factly. What? Oh, I've never told you about that? Yes, well, I tried to strangle myself with a terry cloth towel, and it wasn't very effective, so I just stopped. I don't know how serious I was. She kind of starts chuckling. I'm not sure I believe the chuckle. Mom, that's crushing. Did you ever tell your parents? No, I was young. Didn't that make it even worse? I mean, I'd had some hard days, but I'd never contemplated, let alone attempted, to cut off my airway. Mother was busy sobering up Daddy on and off, and Ted and Phyllis were so much older. I had my dog Trix and my cat. You're killing me, Mom. Killing me. Do you think you were depressed? Did you ever make more friends?
Oh, sure. By high school, our Baptist youth group, I learned to have some fun. But it wasn't until after I recovered from the ulcerative colitis, before I met your dad, that I really started to learn to have fun.
You know, I wouldn't have met your dad without the colitis. My new Christian Science friends, Harold and Ivy, taught me to camp, plan a picnic. Through them, I met your dad. He sure was a lot of fun. Boisterous, charismatic, confident. She says was a lot of fun. And like usual, after we take the full run around the neighborhood, she slows as we pull up to our own house. What does it mean that my mom tried to kill herself with a terry cloth towel? Should we go one more time? Usually we both answered yes, a guilty pleasure. We always lingered longest on our own front drive. I imagine my mother would love to create her own new house and put her aesthetic to the test. But that wasn't happening anytime soon. We were leveraged in cheese. No harm dreaming, though. We'd drive to Laguna Hills and imagine a treehouse, to old L.A. and look at big Spanish ramblers, to beach houses along the cliffs of Corona del Mar. More than anything, she'd say, gazing up at our house dreamily. As a girl, I imagined I would someday live on a ranch in Wyoming, with lots of dogs and animals and wide open spaces. And maybe now, I'd make it modern. Not what you'd expect in Wyoming at all. Chapter 10. About Sex Seminar. Purpose. Explore issues of sex and sexuality. Duration, 10 weeks, 3 hours a week. Equipment needed. The seminar leader has a manual in front of the room. This is one manual I would like to get my hands on. Age, 15. Relationship status. Distant boy crushes. Movies with girlfriends. Ballet class. Time with mom. Employment. My job making country fair cinnamon rolls on Balboa Island doesn't cover the tuition. My parents support one seminar a semester. They think of seminars like other families think of piano lessons. Cost, $225. Humiliation factor, warming up. Location, Newport Beach, California, another office park. I did the About Sex seminar years before I actually kissed a guy, let alone had sex. This was a detail nobody seemed all that concerned about at registration. As for taking a seminar about sex, I was an open-minded prude. I would talk about the topic plenty. I just didn't plan on doing it anytime soon. Sex looked like being under the spell of a man and seeming out of control or rendered speechless with doe eyes. None of it looked appealing. I was wrapped up tight. Love looked messy. Not to mention, I was shy about my body. I was all about ballet and the discipline of it. Didn't think of my body much beyond that. Oh, except masturbating. I knew how to do it and felt insanely guilty about it. Who would like to share their first sexual thought? Michael, the small Spanish seminar leader, asked us. I'd heard that his tall girlfriend, Margot, who had about 5 inches on him, used to be a model. Sure looked that way. I meekly raised my hand. I knew I likely would get called on. There was some novelty in being the youngest person in the group. An assistant handed me a microphone. I remember my first romantic thought. I'm not sure it was sexual, but there was this guy in my class, Ross. He was so cute, so smart. He sat behind me in Mr. Jones' 8th grade homeroom, and I imagined what it would be like if he kissed my neck. Or if he leaned the slightest bit forward, how it might be to feel his breath on my neck. Admit it, Megan. Your thought of this kiss led to thoughts of... I don't think I... Sex, he said. No, I'm not trying to say... I think I wanted to kiss him. Dreamed of his kissing me. But didn't you also imagine sex? I started feeling hot. I could feel this welling up of my eyes, but I wanted none of that. I swallowed it down. I was pretty skilled at this. I knew what was transpiring with the seminar leader. My response didn't fit into whatever was in that manual. Someone is supposed to admit that they wanted to sleep with somebody else. But that wasn't my first thought. I mostly thought about Ross's lips. I wanted to kiss him. By wanting to kiss, Michael said with certainty, rocking up onto his toes for emphasis to the rhythm of his syllables, you, Megan, wanted to be sexual, which means sex. You aren't acknowledging what so. Sex is what so for all of us. That was a common expression, to acknowledge what was so. He scanned the crowd for a new candidate. Now, who else can share their first sexual thought? I looked around awkwardly for a seminar assistant to whom I could hand back the microphone. Chapter 11, The 6-Day Advanced Course. Purpose. They never spelled out what we'd be advanced in. Mom and Renee took the course together a year ago, and Dad the executive version. They each looked happy and lighter in their after photos, way happier than their before photos. I want my face to look brighter, too. Duration, 6 days. Schedule, wake, run, follow the Pritikin diet, do volunteer chores, enter seminar room, be in seminar room until God knows when, exit in wee hours, sleep, repeat. Equipment needed, not exhaustive. The ever-present name tags, running shoes, climbing gear for the ropes course, audio equipment to play the Rocky theme song on our final run, scissors, hairstylists came from San Francisco to give us new looks to transform us into our new, shinier selves. Age, 16.5. Relationship status, single and happy. There's a lot about high school to love. With friends from different groups, I can sort of fit in anywhere. Cost, $750 plus. Humiliation factor, go big or go home. Location, Marin County, California, some old camp-like facility. This is day I don't know what of the 6-day advanced course, an advanced training in the hills outside Napa Valley. I would be the fourth Griswold to get through it. We sleep in bunk rooms. We have seminars from sunup to sundown. As a group of teens, we hail from more affluent and progressive parts of the Bay Area, New York, and Los Angeles, with a few stragglers from other parts of the country and Canada. Most of us enrolled because our parents have done this, and through invitation or coercion, we are to have a life-changing week. Day two is stand-up, sit-down night to explore a relationship with authority. As the trainer instructs us to stand up, sit down, we do exactly that. Stand up and sit down for an hour or more. If you get pissed off or have an easy time of it, no matter, observe your reaction. The next night is scheduled for some other topic, like authenticity. A guy raises his hand to talk. From his presentation, you can tell he's not at the top of the six-day clique hierarchy. He has a feathery blonde mustache with even more feathery blonde hair and a comb in the back pocket of his tight brown OP corduroy shorts. He is not cool. I myself am not at the top of the cool pile either, but neither am I uncool. I would describe my position as cool neutral. My guess is that this guy's lack of coolness will work against him. He stands up and takes the microphone. He has something they call a burning share, a share that burns so hot inside him that it needs to be let out, like a fart. But he's nervous. The trainer, sensing his hesitancy, tries to help. I want you to know that this is a totally safe space, and we are here for you. You are safe, and these people are your partners. And really, you're giving us this gift, because if it's something you've gone through, I guarantee you someone else has gone through it too. You will be helping them. There's no judgment here.
I've done some things I'm not proud of, Featherman says.
Yes, yes, we all have these things. Please, continue.
Well, I've had sex.
Yes, you've had sex. Please.
I've had sex with...
Remember, you will be helping all of us. I've had sex with a Shetland pony. The room goes silent for a half second and then erupts into raging, uncontrollable laughter. The trainer himself looks shocked but pulls it together, trying to look like he's heard this all a million times before. I see the wheels of his mind turning to somehow convince this guy that we're not laughing at him. A tall order, because there is no doubt we are laughing at him. He tries shaming the audience into silence.
Your other partners only laugh because of their immaturity. They are not laughing at you.
But no matter, 100 minds picture this guy with the feathery hair, and then we picture a pony. Not a stallion, not a horse, but a tiny, cute petting zoo pony. Adding to this image is the knowledge of how hard-pressed the trainer is to deliver on his guarantee about how if Feathers has gone through it, somebody else in the room has gone through it too. I'm fairly confident that Feathers is the only person in the room who has had sex with a miniature horse. The next night's seminar was supposed to be sex night. I'd heard from Mom and Renee that they show 3 screens of pornography simultaneously for us to confront our issues around sex. How titillating. 3 different screens. A triptych of porn. I was looking forward to it. They skip over it entirely. No sex night, no porn, no triptych. I suspect they assumed this horse business would cover it. But 5 days have passed, and I haven't experienced my breakthrough yet. And I won't leave here without it. I have this idea about what a breakthrough requires. Pure humiliation, utter fear, and 100% chance of embarrassment. Should I withstand the heat, I imagine the release and salvation to follow.
I came up with this fabulous plan myself, thank you very much. I will be reborn into a braver, stronger version of myself.
This is no small assignment. I've been racking my brain. I finally come up with something worthy of a share. Now I just need the opportunity to share it. We've spent the afternoon roaming around the room in slow motion, assuming Karate Kid-like postures for some samurai leadership something or other. We gathered to review our insights as samurais. I have no insight. In my mind, no insight would be as effective as purging myself. I want to be like Shetland Pony Guy. Without the pony part. I raise my hand. The trainer calls on me. We have 2 trainers. The one who talked to Feathers has a gentle, relaxed air. Not to mention, he looks like a movie star. This trainer is arrogant and squatty, with the high voice of a tenor.
What, Megan, would you like to share about the leadership process?
I fiddle with the edges of my skirt while I stall. I don't want to so much say anything about the leadership process, but I have a burning share.
Oh, a burning chair. Well, yes. Yes. Go on. We have a lot of material to get through, but go ahead. He looks away impatiently. We're off to a bad start, but I suck it up, grip the microphone, and take a big breath. I want to say that I've masturbated. I've masturbated in the shower. I've masturbated in the tub. I've masturbated in the jacuzzi. Nobody's brought up masturbation yet. I think this might be good for the group. I've looked at Playboy, at Playgirl. Excuse me, Megan. I've masturbated in the... Excuse me, Megan. Excuse me, Megan. He interrupts my list. I won't be stopped. One time I took off my... Megan, stop. Squat man calls me to a halt with his Bryan Adams on a bad day voice. Once I found some porn in my parents' closet, it was Germa... Megan, we all have things we feel shame about. Seems best you move on. Best I move on? Was this guy gonna blow me off? They spent like an hour talking to the guy about the horse, and now because it was some minor masturbation guilt, he wasn't going to give me the time of day. This might have been the leadership exercise, but Feathers got to talk about the horse during the integrity workshop. They treated him like a brave soldier recounting the horrors of war. The man had fucked a horse, for Christ's sake. He wasn't a hero. Squatty requests I sit down. I start sobbing. I wasn't even tormented in the right way. I wanted to confess and come out the other side, clearer, brighter. I felt more alive when I thought somebody knew the worst in me. Chapter 12. The Retreat Workshop on Self-Government. Purpose. Develop skills of self-government. To be more self-actualized, self-disciplined, self-reflective. A lot of words that begin with a self and a dash. Duration. 5 days. Equipment needed. Pen and paper. Age, 17. Relationship status. I haven't mentioned it, but I won a ballet scholarship a while back. My patron sees something in me. But I've given it up. I loved it, but there's too much stress with Dad gone with work and Renee finishing UCLA. I think my time is better spent on things like autonomy. Yeah, autonomy. Mom's super into it. Cost. Somewhere more than $500, but less than $1,000. Humiliation factor. I don't feel humiliation so much as guilt. Location. Lovely rural spot popular with retreat leaders everywhere. Brighton Bush Hot Springs meets Taos, New Mexico meets Alice Waters. Trying to keep it vague, not interested in throwing anyone under the bus. Mom started a new training in self-government with a capital S. I'm not sure what it means. Well, I know what self-government means. I looked it up. But I'm not sure what it means to learn it. It's a new teacher she found through a friend of a friend. His name is Lawrence, and he's some sort of authority. He has a short retreat, then an ongoing class. Mom did the retreat and headed straight into the ongoing. Marilyn from our Phoenix S trip is doing it too. They say it's really different from what we've done. I've signed up for the retreat, and so here I am with Mom. No pressure, but Mom thinks it might inform my thinking on what's next, with college looming and all. It's got the familiar name tags and chairs, but this feels more academic. Tables in front of us with pen and paper. I love that we'll be writing. Not that I know what we'll be writing. And I love that Lawrence is this refined, rather starched shirt version of a seminar. We're reading his book, Tracing the Development of Western Philosophy. How did we get to thinking the way we do? How did religious thought lead to thinkers like Plato, Rousseau, Nietzsche, and Freud? If my last seminars felt like a mishmash of jazzy phrases, this feels far more intellectual. Here's the only problem. If my seminars and 6-day advanced course aren't a cult, then why do I feel incredibly guilty for doing this retreat? So guilty that I'm missing an afternoon session for fear I'm crossing into enemy territory or in the very least a competitor's camp. Even I know there's only so much personal growth business to go around. I don't want to lose my friends there, but truth is, I've found some cracks. Like, how can you teach a whole seminar on integrity when you're doing not-so-integrity-ish things? Not that Mom and I have told anyone, but because we host seminar leaders in our house, occasionally we see the leaders' private lives more than most. Mom runs our guest room like a mini B&B.
which the seminar leaders find homier than hotels. But with the last leader we hosted, I was awakened in the night by some pretty loud moaning. Alarmed, I woke Mom and dragged her upstairs to listen with me. Definitely sex sounds. With my detective self in full swing, we confirmed an additional car parked out front. With custom Arizona plates I recognize, some variation on the word karma. No joke. And I happen to know our karma driver is the married enrollment manager who leads my phone enrollment night. After karma departed before dawn, upon changing the bed later in the day, Mom and I discovered that, like Cinderella, karma had left something behind. A big black-and-white polka-dot plastic hoop earring. I would recognize karma's jewelry anywhere. So if integrity teachers have vow-breaking sex with married people, and if I heard anti-anger teachers yelling in the hall on enrollment night, well, I'd tolerate a massive guilty stomach ache during a retreat to try something new. So here I am. Lawrence says he understands my seminar loyalty and stomach ache, and that no one has taken his class so young, so if it doesn't speak to me, there's no problem with leaving. But I want to hear what happens with Freud and something called the homunculus. I want to finish Lawrence's book to see how it ends, or maybe how it begins. Chapter 13, Our Bodies, Ourselves.